This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Quentin Tarantino delivers one of the more unique films of his career in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Pixar has a bad case of sequelitis with Toy Story 4, and the Lion King remake exists, but should it?
Just behind Andrew's shoulder right now is my wife's Simba keychain that she purchased in Disney World as a child. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking to myself that that's exactly what an animated lion should look like. It should not look like the photorealistic garbage that we got with Jon Favreau just playing God with this. And you know, honest, all right, so I'm just going to take a step back before because I can already feel myself starting to go off the rails. The Lion King is a remake of The Lion King from 1994, the beloved animated film, and is the next in the long line of Disney quote-unquote live-action films. I don't know, there's one shot that's actually live-action in this, but everything else is just like completely fabricated in the digital realm. And that's totally fine. I understand they wanted to push the technology a la Avatar, and I admired Avatar for what it did in the digital realm and what these below-the-line craftsmen were able to pull off. And honestly, I actually, you know, respect what they were able to pull off. Caleb Deschanel has obviously one of the best working cinematographers in Hollywood history. Really has a keen eye and brings this world to life in a way that, even if it shouldn't have been, is at least never not interesting to look at. Even if it's dead-eyed and creepy, it's well-rendered. And there are times, I mean, some of the backgrounds in particular are stunning. A lot of the animal renderings are really cute. And I use the word cute because, you know, there are some cute moments in it, and that's fine. I'm not going to rehash the story. You've seen the animated film, so you already know what the hell the movie's about. And it's basically just Hamlet with lions. The issue that I have with this film, and it's the issue that everyone else has been pointing out, so I don't want to be redundant about it, but this is just not, and I had the same issue with Aladdin, this is just not a story that works well in this, you know, photorealistic way. There's a vibrancy to the original animated film, there's color and, you know, whimsy to it that is just completely lacking in this film. And that's, I mean, I understand that this was, I don't see any other reason that they made this aside from the technological push, and obviously Disney had dollar signs lighting up in their eyes, and so it was inevitable. I mean, there was no way we were getting out of it. But you know, just in everything, I gotta say, I'm a big Donald Glover fan, I'm a big Childish Gambino fan. I don't think, and maybe it was just Jon Favreau's direction, I don't know, but I think he fell flat. I think most of the cast fell flat in this. Chiwetel Ejiofor's Scar was just kind of bland. James Earl Jones is, you know, I know he's older, but he just sounded a lot more haggard and disinterested than he has been. The musical sequence is just really, God, be prepared. What the hell was that, man? Some of these musical sequences just have no pep to them. You know, you go back and watch the Hakuna Matata sequences, and they tried to do shot for shot stuff, but it's just like, you go back to like Hakuna Matata, I Just Can't Wait to Be King, and there's like, you know, this like rhythmic pulse in the visuals that's missing. The music is still there, we still have Hans Zimmer's iconic score, and honestly, I'll still go to bat for that. I'm not like over the top huge fan of the original film, but it is one of my favorite film scores of all time. I think Hans Zimmer is a genius, and I'm really glad that, if nothing else, that was used effectively. But there are just like some things. I think it was David Ehrlich who called this the equivalent of Gus Van Sant's Psycho, and I think that's pretty much an apt comparison. There's just like, it's completely soulless and dead. And I like Jon Favreau, and I think he does a couple little nice panaches. I think Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen are really good as Timon and Pumbaa, but that's really, you know, that's the crux of it. I think some of these action sequences just feel completely lifeless, and it's just, you know, I feel like I'm just saying the same shit I said when I did the Aladdin review. This is just something that, some things are better left to the canvas.
Well, at least in Aladdin, there was some of that classic Disney magic, at least intermittently, and there was a sense of fun. There is none of that here in this film. You hit it right on the head is the word I was going to use. It feels soulless. It's the most soulless Disney movie I can remember in quite some time. And you know, I disagree with you on one point that it's always interesting to look at. I completely disagree with that. I think there are some interesting visuals. I think Caleb Deschanel, you know, at that moment where Simba is chasing Rafiki through the woods, I thought there's some really stunning visuals there. But I mean, you mentioned the color palette. I think that is something that is missing incredibly in this. You know, I caught, you know, as a part of the Beauty and the Beast live action remake that was on TV the other day or something, and I caught part of it, and I was like, see, this film at least, you know, it pulls off the musical sequences. I know not everyone's a fan of that, but I am. I think it's the best, at least the best of the live action remakes, because there's actually energy to the musical sequences. Obviously, I think Bill Condon is a big part of that. He's known for musicals, so it makes sense. With Aladdin, it's not always consistent, but there is at least some color to it. To you, I think you hit the nail right on the head when you said, mentioned the musical sequences. You know, I just can't wait to be king. You know, it's like watching photorealistic versions of these animals do it is far less interesting, and it's not taking advantage. The reason 2D animation worked so well for this classic golden age of Disney animation is because you were able to achieve various things. You get to see Simba going all crazy. Instead, in this, you get to see a dead-eyed, like lifeless photorealistic animal just to sort of stroll through, and you know, he's running and stuff, but you can't do as much interesting things. And to be honest, I have a hard time putting much of this on Jon Favreau, because I feel like what happened was, you know, I watched some of the behind the scenes stuff, and he's like coaching up the actors in the studio, and then I just feel like, you know, the animators just didn't, you know, or you know, the animators, because that's what essentially they are, you know, it's essentially an animated remake. To call it even live action is, you know, a bit ridiculous. But I feel like it was just handed off, and then Disney's like, oh, we got to get this out there, and we're not. And I feel like some of the shots, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I just couldn't believe what I was watching. I feel like there's none of the emotional weight of the original animated film. I'm sorry, but when Mufasa dies, I felt nothing, and that is a problem. And I think from what I've talked about on this podcast and what I talk about in life, I'm a very emotional person. It doesn't take that much of me to be, you know, to get a bit emotional in a film. And when Mufasa dies and I feel nothing, there is something wrong, you know, with this film. You know, like I said, I think the color palette, missing a lot of the creative visuals that are, you know, easy to do or possible in 2D animation. I just don't think they're that possible, or the effort wasn't put in to make these musical sequences very interesting. I also think this film desperately needed its own identity. That's something that some of these other, you know, say what you will about Aladdin, is certainly not great, but it definitely has its own identity. It has different choices it made. It has things that it brought in to make it feel a bit more full. Some of those choices work, some of them do not, you know, but it was an attempt. Here, like I said, soulless is the right word for it, because it's basically just a carbon copy, you know, and I think the running time for this film is somehow longer than the original, and it makes no sense to me. You know, I honestly was trying to figure this out. Like, it's like I don't understand how the running time is longer, because basically they truncate, you know, some of the musical sequences, and there's not, I think the only difference I can recall is the Beyonce song when she's running back to the Pride Land sort of towards the end when her and adult Simba are running. That's the only thing I could think of that was a major difference that really stuck out to me. Everything else is just almost exactly how it is in the 2D animation. It just looks worse. It's not as visually engaging. And, you know, I just want to talk about, you know, the general public in general and their response to this film, because, you know, I feel like there's a lot of people who are on our side, and this is, yeah, it's just lackluster, mediocre. It just doesn't have the energy of the original. But when I saw this in the theater, there wasn't that many people there. I saw it during the day sometime. I think there was like a couple parents and their kids. And at the end, they clapped. And I'm just saying, you know, this is something, you know, I understand people's attachment to The Lion King, but if you watch this film and you view it the same way you view the original, I don't know what you're watching. You know, everyone was hyped about the cast, and I think you rightfully point out, I think Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner are the clear standouts. I think it's about as perfect modern casting as you can get for these characters. I can't imagine two other actors in the roles in this modern retelling, so that really works. But yeah. And honestly, you know, once again, I don't really put much of it on, you know, a lot of the lead actors, like you mentioned, Donald Glover and stuff. Where was the material? I mean, like I said, it's just a carbon copy of the original. And I think what a lot of people forget about the original is that, you know, once Simba becomes an adult and is voiced by Matthew Broderick, you know, that was when it wasn't a good performance, you know, at the time either. And there just isn't that much. I think people forget that there isn't that much, you know, to that second half of the film. It's sort of like, you know, oh, this happens, and then it's over. And essentially this plays out the same way. So, you know, when they, you know, announced this cast, everyone was pumped, but they were never going to have, I don't think, that great material. And when you cast these amazing actors, you should at least give them something to sink their teeth into. And they didn't. You know, you mentioned Chiwetel Ejiofor. I have to say, you know, I actually didn't mind him as Scar, but the problem is he completely pales in comparison to one of the greatest, you know, performances in the 2D animated realm by Jeremy Irons as the original Scar. And you mentioned Be Prepared. That, I'll be honest, in the theater when I saw what they did, where he's just spoken word, I'm like, oh, so they're going into Be Prepared, and then it was over in a second after he said it once. I was like, are you serious? Like, yes, you don't have to use the Nazi imagery from the original 2D animation, but it's one of the best songs in Disney's catalog, I think, bar none. You know, and the fact that you don't even take advantage of that is ridiculous. I don't know if they were I don't know if Chiwetel Ejiofor just isn't much of a singer and they didn't want to hire someone else to do it or something, but it just felt really lazy. And like I said, these moments, you know, like, I'm not like one of these Disney obsessives, but I watched a lot of these, you know, 2D animated films growing up, and, you know, there's a real sense of fun and magic to it. At no point in this movie did I ever feel a sense of fun until, you know, Rogan and Billy Eichner had a bit of back and forth. That was the only point where I was like, oh, at least there's something here. But where the hell is the Disney magic, damn it?
So, a couple things. Yes, you are right. This film is longer by a good half hour or so, and I think a lot of that is... I was trying to figure that out myself. There's a lot more digital wankery, I'll call it. It's just showing off the technology, and there are a lot more, not even establishing shots, there are just a lot more wide shots of the landscape and more random animals just kind of thrown in, and they really just like stretch it out longer than it really needs to be. When I saw this movie, it was sold out in the showcase North Attleboro, which admittedly those theaters are a lot smaller, but yes, the audience did clap at the end of it too. And I'm just going to go on the same tirade that I went on during the Aladdin review, and that, you know, this is, we're suckers of, you and I, maybe we're to blame for this because we will literally go and watch anything, period, and that's, you know, so we are partially to blame for this. I'm not going to deny that, but I think, you know, I'm going back to the old Jay Sherman mantra: if the movie stinks, just don't go. And I think people are like, I don't know, Disney, you don't owe Disney anything. You don't owe them your loyalty, because they damn sure don't see you as anything more than a dollar sign. And I don't think they saw the Lion King property as anything more than a dollar sign. And I don't know. I feel like I'm just going in circles with this crap, and I'm saying the same thing every time we do one. But, you know, if anything, I'm going to look to the future, because I think that Mulan trailer actually, you know what? Credit where credit's due, that is a, I feel that that might be a property that would translate well into the live action realm, and I think there was some pretty interesting imagery in that. I think it's, I want to say Nico Case, that is not accurate, I the name escapes me, but she did Whale Rider and North Country, but I think that that's, and you know, we're probably going to get like Hercules and another fucking live action Tarzan movie, but again, in the Disney panache realm, but I think that, you know, I would say that Disney needs to be picky and choosy about all this, but they fucking own like half of the box office at this point, so no one's going to listen to me.
Well, it's smart that you bring up Mulan, because that's something that clearly has its own identity, because it's not going to be a musical, first off, which I think is a blessing and a curse, because I think Mulan has a couple of dynamite songs, but, you know, I think... clearly, with that in mind, it's going to have its own identity. There's not going to be, I guarantee there's probably not going to be Eddie Murphy voicing a dragon in it, you know, and it's clearly, like I said, they're clearly going with a different identity. We'll see how it turns out. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but at least they're doing their own thing. With The Lion King, like I said, I just feel like it's just there on the screen. I just couldn't believe it. It just felt so lackluster, and just even some of the repeating of the shots, like I mentioned Mufasa's death, and they have that iconic shot where it like zooms out from Simba or whatever, and I was like, you know, they had that in there, but in the 2D animation I actually felt something. In this version I was just like, huh? And basically, the Lion King remake gets a big shrug from me as a review, because that's what it is. It's just there on the screen, and all I want to say to audiences is, you know, you deserve better than this, you know, and I want people, like, I don't feel like this is something where, like, oh, we're film enthusiasts, wow, you know, this is why we're criticizing it. I'm sorry, I think mainstream audiences should be able to see right through this. I mean, it's clearly there on the screen, and it's just, I don't know if people just haven't seen the original in a while, but this is like a tenth of the film that is, and that might even be giving this film too much credit, but I think we can turn our attention, I'm gonna turn my attention to my thoughts on Toy Story 4, a film that we meant to get back to way back in, was it June when it came out or something at this point? But I did get around to it a couple weeks back. And safe to say, Toy Story 4 is, you know, a solid Toy Story sequel. But I think that's clearly a criticism when you're talking about a Pixar film. You know, Toy Story 3 absolutely emotionally wrecked me, like I know it did a lot of people. You know, I think I saw it opening night and I was weeping in the theater like a lot of other people were, and it really felt like the perfect end. The thing about Toy Story 4 is it's solid. It's a solid adventure for these characters, but I don't think it did enough to justify its existence. It's just one of these other, like I mentioned in the intro, it's, you know, Pixar has had a case of sequelitis in recent times, and I know a lot of people, you know, weren't big fans of whatever Monsters University or whatever. I liked it, but it's certainly not on the level of the original, and that's the case with a lot of these sequels. But Toy Story was different. It was a franchise that its sequels were highly, highly praised. And then they make Toy Story 4, where it's just sort of another adventure. And I will say, you know, there is some emotional resonance, as there always is in Toy Story. And at the end, there was a few moments that, you know, I did get a bit emotional about it. But in general, the film is just, it's just another adventure. And this is Pixar. And another film should just not be another adventure for these characters. It's always, they always strive for originality. They always strive for to really pull the heartstrings, but do so in a way that's unique and original. And I feel like that just isn't a lot there in a lot of these sequels, in particular, you know, in Toy Story 4. Like I said, I think it's a good film, but when all the other Toy Story films are really great or fantastic or almost perfect, as some people would say, you know, it's just hard to, it just doesn't stack up in terms of the franchise. In terms of some of the cast additions, I think Key and Peele are really fun as these Duck and Bunny characters. They have this really fun sequence where they're imagining how they can get this item, and it's just really, and they're just sort of imagining, and then they're just like, and then they go back to the present and they're like, yeah, Buzz is like, yeah, that's not gonna happen. And I think there's perfect casting for them with their great personalities, and they just sort of jump off the screen with these animated characters. I also liked Keanu, who plays a Canadian stuntman, Duke Kaboom, Keanu Reeves, of course, not to be confused with the Keanu film that Key and Peele made. I just thought of that connection. I wasn't even thinking about that. But I really thought Keanu was going to be a bigger part of the film. He was good in the role, but I was expecting him to turn out to be the villain or something, which is not the case. One of the unexpected surprises in the film was who essentially played the villain, which is Christina Hendricks, played Gabby, and essentially part of the film takes place in this sort of antique store, and you know, I thought that was part that there was clearly something there, but it just wasn't developed enough, or it wasn't really hit home enough as they did in a lot of the other previous Toy Story films, where she had this connection, she wanted to be owned by a child, she's been in this antique store, she's trying to at one point steal Woody's you know, voice box because she thinks that's gonna help this child connect with her, and it's, you know, it really definitely pulls at the heartstrings a bit at times, but it's once again, it was something that was there and present in the film for a little bit, and then it just felt like it was glossed over a bit at a certain point. There's a fun Buzz Lightyear running gag where he's listening to his inner voice. I forget who it is, but a character, I think Woody or someone, tells him you should listen to your inner voice, and it's one of the classic Buzz tropes where he's hitting the buttons on his chest and it's saying things, and he's like, oh, that's my inner voice. You know, so it's one of those classic sort of dumb Buzz Lightyear running gags, but I thought it worked for the film itself. And in terms of Forky, the newest addition to the Toy Story Clan, played by Tony Hale, I mean, I thought he was all right. There was, you know, early on, there's some fun montages where Woody's trying to, you know, help Forky out, you know, make him believe that, you know, their kid, their owner, you know, needs him. You know, he thinks he's just trash. So that's kind of a fun dynamic where he's always running to the trash because he doesn't think he's, you know, worthy of being a toy. But just overall, like I said, I think it's a solid sequel. It's not bad by any stretch. I liked it, but this is a Toy Story film, a Toy Story sequel, and I, like I said, I don't feel like it did enough to justify its existence. And, you know, Pixar, come on, you guys don't need, and I know they've made a clear effort, and clearly their slate coming up is more heavy on the originals, so I'm looking forward to a lot of those. But I'm just saying, you know, we expect more from Pixar because of their track record, and they don't need to go down this Disney route of money, 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 money.
No one owes Disney anything, period, full stop. Before we transition to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a la Quentin Tarantino's imagination, I want to ask you, a trailer dropped, and I didn't even see it until last night, and this is a movie that was, I don't even remember where it placed on my top 10 most anticipated, Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse. I finally got to see the trailer for that. Holy shit, man, this movie looks absolutely phenomenal. It's 90 seconds of just, like, pure stunning imagery, and Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe just tearing the scenery apart. You really need to go out of your way and watch this. I know that not everyone is going to have a good reaction to this, because not everyone had a good reaction to The Witch. You know, I don't care. You know what? I'm so sick of, like, you know, apologizing for my elitist crap. I like what I like, period. The Witch is a fucking masterpiece, and The Lighthouse is going to be too.
Yeah, man, what an incredible trailer. You know, it has that sort of silent film vibe, the look to it. I love the, you know, the black and white, and obviously it being a two-hander between, you know, Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. I mean, two amazing actors. Yes, Pattinson is an amazing actor. People, check out his indie stuff and you'll realize that. And I'm sure he's going to be blowing it up with a role in Christopher Nolan's newest film, and obviously playing Batman for Matt Reeves. But yeah, I'm really pumped for it. I mentioned to you, I listened to this, A24, the studio that's making and putting out Lighthouse, they have this really fun podcast, which it can be infrequent at times, but typically, basically the podcast, it doesn't have a regular host. Basically, they get two filmmakers together and they just discuss. And there was this great conversation between Robert Eggers and Ari Aster, who directed, of course, Hereditary and Midsommar. And, you know, it was this great conversation. And it was just really fun just listening to these filmmakers. This is something I live for. I just love listening to podcasts involving filmmakers, because I feel like it definitely, I don't know, I just find it really enlightening to hear their perspective, to hear them reference, you know, nerd out about filmmakers that I love as well. So I definitely recommend, if anyone hasn't checked out, you know, I mean, A24 is doing great work in the film screen, but they're also doing great work in the podcast realm. But yeah, definitely a film that I think obviously we're going to cover here on the podcast, and I couldn't be, you know, more pumped for it after that incredible trailer. But with that being said, now we're going to turn our attention to, safe to say, sort of, I would say, you know, the last big event film of the summer. Obviously, Hobbs and Shaw just came out, but, you know, it's Hobbs and Shaw. It's a Fast and Furious spinoff. I'm sure it's crazy, you know, ridiculous fun, but we're not going to get to it at this point. But safe to say, Quentin Tarantino's latest, safe to say, has taken the film world by storm. There's been so many articles written about it. And I have to say, you know, I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood about, like, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago now, and I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about it. I think it's simultaneously the most intriguing and baffling film of Quentin Tarantino's career, because it doesn't feel like a lot of other of Quentin Tarantino's other work. It's almost like a lackadaisical California Odyssey that's not particularly interested in those typical fantastical, overly violent sequences that Tarantino is known for. Obviously, up to a point, as the film, of course, eventually gets to a certain sequence that will show that off. And we'll definitely talk about specifics here, because everyone who's wanted to see this has seen it at this point. But like I said, you know, I think what I'm intrigued about by the film is that I'm not entirely sure what Tarantino's intentions are, other than, you know, he's showing his love for this era of film, an era of TV, etc. But I don't know, there was never, you know, something that I was like, oh, what is he getting at here? Because, you know, in a lot of other Tarantino films, like I said, you know, am I Tarantino's biggest fan? No, but I've enjoyed the overwhelming majority of his films. You know, I really love, as I've talked about in the past, Jackie Brown, Kill Bill Volume 2. You know, I think Inglourious Basterds is a really entertaining film. But this is a different, like I said, this is a different breed of Tarantino. And I almost admire it, because I wasn't expecting it. You know, there isn't, you know, I think a lot of people are going to go into this, you know, oh, look, they got Brad Pitt, Leo DiCaprio, they're going to be spouting the classic Tarantino dialogue. I have to say, there isn't much of that classic Tarantino dialogue here, and I have to wonder if it was a conscious choice, or whether he's just trying to do something, you know, a bit different. You know, there are moments, but it's just not the focus, like the dialogue is, like, so many times in Tarantino's, you know, previous other work, you know. And I also, with this being said, because it doesn't have these trademark Tarantino things, I don't feel like the appeal is really there for a lot of mainstream audiences. I know most people are going to go see this, and I feel like a lot of film obsessives will really get into it. And like I said, I feel like I probably need a second viewing to really know exactly my feelings on it. I think I overall enjoyed the film, but even saying that, I'm not sure. You know, like I said, I feel like it's one of these films that has to sort of grow on me, and I have to check it out again to see if other elements of it click, you know, for me. But, you know, just talking about, you know, probably my favorite sequence in the film centers around Leo DiCaprio's character, Rick Dalton, and him having this interaction with this young actress or whatever. And he's on set, you know, filming this classic Western show. And they have this really great scene where she's just sort of, you know, she's taking her craft seriously. And Rick Dalton clearly isn't. He's in a sort of tough time in his life. And I will say, you know, I do think Rick Dalton is a really interesting character. And some of the elements of him, I would say, you know, some of it is the most I've felt for a Tarantino character. You know, I've talked about in the past on this, you know, podcast how I think the reason I'm not as big a Tarantino fan as a lot of other people are is because, you know, I don't ever see myself or connect to his characters in that way. But I think Rick Dalton is an exception because he's clearly this actor going through a crisis, and he's clearly, you know, I don't know, it's just something about the way Leo plays it in those particular scenes where he's on the set of this Western show that I really enjoyed, and I wish there was more of that throughout the rest of the film.
I have a very complicated relationship with Tarantino and his movies. And I know I've gotten crap for this in the past, but the cultural context in which these films exist and a lot of his, let's just say, casting himself so he can use racial epithets has always rubbed me the wrong way. And there's always been like that icky layer to it. And, you know, that much ado about the sequence with Bruce Lee in this film, which is just flat out embarrassing, regardless of how you feel about the rest of the film. I know you're giving me that look right now. That just like really made my skin crawl at times. As far as the movie overall itself, I don't know. I just felt kind of ambivalent to it at the end of the day, leaning towards slightly negative. And I think that's just because, like, overall, you watch one of Tarantino's movies, you get that peppy dialogue and that. But for a lot of times, honestly, like you, there isn't much to latch onto from an emotional standpoint. And a lot of times I find myself just like kind of glazing over. And I had that same issue last night, even if it wasn't that, you know, trademark Tarantino rapid fire dialogue that we normally get. A lot of times I just kind of spaced out. There wasn't anything that was like super interesting. And I think that's because the film is, and it's completely by design. It's just a buddy comedy that takes place over the course of one day. And, you know, you have three intersecting stories with the Rick Dalton. You have Brad Pitt's stuntman character and Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate. And obviously all three of the central performances. These are fantastic actors. And obviously, I have no complaints about any of this. Robert Richards' cinematography, obviously, again, one of the best working cinematographers. And I would say better than Caleb Deschanel, probably. He knows how to wring out that tension through a shot. He knows how to get that last little bit of extra emotion. He knows how to make, 1969 LA feel like this vibrant community. But, you know, and this, obviously, this is in every Tarantino movie where there are just, like, a lot of throwaway scenes. Like, we have Damian Lewis showing up as Steve McQueen and just, like, kind of narrating and explaining who Sharon Tate is in her relationship to the Alan Smithy of the 70s and just it's in J.C. Bring and all this stuff. And it just feels like kind of tacked on. There's no other reason for the Sharon Tate to be in this film as a character other than the fact that Tarantino maybe wanted to give her the ending she deserved as a person and, you know, to show his admiration for her and for her feet and for several other pairs of feet in this film as well, as is his want to do. I'm not kink shaming. I'm just saying it really stands out, man. But, you know, overall, it's Tarantino. Your mileage is going to vary on it, but I think, you know, we were discussing a little bit beforehand, this might actually be the least accessible film he's ever made, and that's saying something, because most of his movies are pushing 3 hours and are really just, like, exhausting at times. But this is just kind of, and again, it's by design, it's just like a lackadaisical homage to the time period in which he grew up and the city in which he grew up, and that's fine. I love LA. I think it's a wonderful city, and there's a lot of great culture there, and there's a lot of great history there as a film buff. That really just, you know, kind of tickles my fancy. And I obviously feel horrible about Sharon Tate, and I really like what they ended up doing with that infamous moment. And I think that kind of plays out in a way that is, I don't know. It's Tarantino. I think that a lot of times when he has these bursts of violence that they're meant to be played off comedically, kind of like in Kill Bill Volume 1, which is totally, you know, I laughed my ass off through that movie, and I laughed my ass off like through the last 20 minutes of this. So I'll give, you know, credit where credit's due. I was entertained by that. But overall, it all comes back to Tarantino the man, and he was, you know, not dismissed, but like, you know, pegged as a loudmouth pop culture junkie, and that's writ large here. And again, there's still some queasy racial stuff in here that rubs me the wrong way. And I know I'm in the minority and everyone tells me to shut up about that, but again, going back to the elitist crap, I like what I like and I don't like that.
Well, it's funny you mention, you know, the feet in this film, because I feel like it's one of the only times in a Tarantino movie where, given the time period and hippie culture, it actually works. So I'll give him that. I'll give him a pass, you know, for that. And also, I will give credit, you know, to his casting of Margaret Qualley as one of Charlie's disciples, because it's about as perfect casting as you can get. And I've loved her ever since I saw her on The Leftovers. So, hey, it's great casting work there. But there is one element I want to talk about specifically that I personally think is some of the worst writing Tarantino has ever done, and it's this completely baffling and completely unnecessary voiceover. I couldn't even believe what I was listening to. Like, there's that sequence where I really love Brad Pitt in this, where he's just playing, you know, he's playing that laid back Brad Pitt character. But I will say, I didn't mind watching him drive around for a little bit. Although, I will say that I do feel like there's a lot of time in this movie, particularly early on, that could be easily cut out, and the film would be none worse for the wear for it. But there's a sequence where Brad Pitt is up on the roof, you know, trying to fix it, and I believe that is the sequence. And I was really surprised by this, where it's the only scene in the film where Charlie Manson is, and you've already seen the scene if you've seen the trailer. And I will say, you know, I almost like I don't know if I really can say this as a criticism, because I almost admire him because he's not glorifying it. He's not, you know, bringing Charlie Manson too much into the story. But I also expected a bit more from that, especially because we had the element of the family, you know, in there in different sequences. But, you know, getting back to this voiceover, I honestly think it is the worst writing Tarantino's ever done. Like, there's this montage, you know, late in the film with timestamps, and I'm like, we get it, man. Like, I'd much rather watch, you know, Leo and Brad Pitt converse and drink alcohol in their house without hearing Kurt Russell's voice over it just telling me what I'm seeing. Like, that's what I mean, I couldn't even believe it. Like I said, overall, I enjoyed the film, but that element in particular, I was baffled. What's Tarantino doing here? This voiceover is completely unnecessary. It's basically stating what we're seeing on screen, and he's also, you know, like I said, I love Kurt Russell's voice too, but it doesn't mean, you know, you have to put it in there. That was one element I was taken aback by. It completely took me out of the movie, and I can honestly say, you know, even though I'm not the biggest Tarantino fan, I've never had a reaction like that, where like, oh man, that writing is really terrible. You know, I've never had that reaction to Tarantino, although, yes, there are certainly sequences he's made that I was like, yeah, I probably wouldn't write it that way, but that was an element that I was like, it just completely took me out of the movie, and I can't believe, I haven't heard people talking about that, and I know it's a minor part of the movie, but it completely took me out of it. I thought it was some of the... I think it is the worst writing of Tarantino's career. And you mentioned that it takes place over a day. Well, that is true up to a point, because we have that weird six-month time jump. And that's the thing. I understand, you know, obviously we're following, you know, fictional characters, you know, throughout this film. And I feel like, obviously, the purpose of that time jump is to line up, you know, with the infamous night of Charlie Manson's murders. And I guess now we can get into the specifics of this interesting climax. And like you said, you know, I definitely, you know, I don't even know what to say about it. You know, I enjoyed Acid Trip Brad Pitt and Leo, you know, using the flamethrower. I also saw, like, earlier online today, apparently Leo disliked using the flamethrower on people because he's such a good guy. He didn't want to use it on people, which I think is really funny. But I don't know, the whole Manson of it all feels very out of place. Like I alluded to, you know, he's only in literally one shot or something. Well, I guess there's a couple shots in there, but yeah, it's that, like, if you've seen the trailer and you've seen that shot of him, that's pretty much the experience of Charlie Manson, you know, in this film. And like I said, I respect him for not glorifying it, but it felt like he needed to play a role or something, you know, in this climax if he really wanted to go fully, you know, Tarantino changing history again. And, you know, I saw online or, you know, on social media or whatever, people be like, how could people not see this coming? Tarantino did this in Inglourious Basterds. Well, in Inglourious Basterds, the whole film is a changing of history. And so when people are blown away, Hitler and stuff, it's not that shocking. shocking. Here, you know, it feels like it comes, you know, out of nowhere. And I've heard people say that, you know, when you watch the film a second time, you know, it plays completely differently once you know this ending, where essentially, you know, Brad Pitt takes acid, you know, he takes his dog for a walk, and then, you know, essentially the family, you know, of people who, you know, in real life, you know, killed, obviously, Sharon Tate, you know, they essentially enter Rick Dalton's home, and they get into, you know, a fight with Brad Pitt and Leo's new Italian wife. I mean, Leo's just out lounging on the pool, you know, listening to stuff. I liked different touches like that. Like I said, I like Rick Dalton as a character. I just feel like I said, and there were some sequences where I really felt emotionally attached to him, but then the rest of the movie didn't really follow up on that. I've also seen some criticism where, you know, Brad Pitt and Leo aren't actually in this film together much. They don't actually share a lot of scenes, which is interesting, but safe to say, you know, this climax is essentially, it's the explosion of violence that we expect from a lot of Tarantino films. Typically, you expect it throughout. Here, it's just, you know, sectioned off to this ending sort of climactic sequence, and like you said, I enjoyed it. I had a few laughs here and there, but like I said, at the end of the day, I really don't know exactly what Tarantino's intentions are, and that's why it's something I definitely am going to rewatch this film, because like I said, I feel like I don't have a distinct opinion on it. I would say, you know, I guess I enjoyed it overall, but even saying that, I'm not entirely sure, you know, and I think, you know, like I said, I admire that Tarantino's clearly doing something different here. But I question if there is any real depth there. And I question the purpose of a lot of the scenes in this film. There's that, you know, scene with Bruce Dern, which is very odd. Like, I didn't mind. I thought, you know, Brad Pitt interacting with the family, I guess I was all right with that. But the Bruce Dern thing, I was like, so what is exactly the point of this sequence? You know, and I feel like there was more of that in this film than I've ever expected, you know, from, you know, a Tarantino film. And, you know, another thing I wanted to mention, you know, about Tarantino is I feel like he has this tendency, you know, to like cut down other filmmakers or other films. You know, anytime he's in the media spotlight or he has, you know, a film being released, he has this tendency to cut down other filmmakers or other things, and I just never understand that, why he does that. And I especially don't understand it now, because, you know, I think this is, you know, like I said, I think there's some questionable decisions that Tarantino made in this film. You know, you mentioned the Bruce Lee sequence. I will say, I wouldn't say I have as big an issue with that sequence as a lot of other people do. I feel like sometimes people really look for these racial things with Tarantino because, you know, for obvious, you know, reasons. I don't feel like that sequence is really racial in any way, you know? I mean, I feel like, you know, I got what he was doing. He was trying to convey, you know, that Brad Pitt's, I don't know why I keep blanking on this character's name. I remember Rick Dalton, but I can't remember Brad Pitt's stuntman's name, but I got that he was trying to convey that Brad Pitt is dangerous. And, you know, there's that weird, I just reminded myself of this, there's that weird dangling thread that about Brad Pitt, like, killing his wife, you know, and that never really comes back around. And I feel like he was trying to convey something in the, specifically in that scene that, oh yes, obviously, Brad Pitt, you know, his stuntman character isn't Bruce Lee, but he's clearly dangerous, and I got what he was trying to convey, and apparently the original version of that sequence from what I'm hearing was even worse, and Brad Pitt actually won right out. So, you know, keep that in mind, so be blessed that we ended up with that. But yeah, I don't know, I've never seen a Tarantino film where I was completely baffled by some of the decisions, and like I said, I think some poor writing choices in general, which, like I said, while I enjoyed the film overall as an experience, like I said, I still don't know exactly how I feel about it, but I am looking forward to revisiting it to see if it plays any differently on a second viewing.
So I want to touch upon this Bruce Lee thing really quick, just so I can kind of like explain where I'm coming from on it. Yes, it's not nearly as bad as, like, you know, him casting himself as a slave owner, or, you know, the choice language that he used in Pulp Fiction about letting a deceased African-American stay in his garage. What it is, and, you know, obviously Bruce Lee's daughter came out and said, you know, Bruce was a guy who encountered a lot of prejudice when he was working in Hollywood and was a very, you know, dignified and modest individual. And Tarantino just kind of turns that on his head and turns him into a complete braggart. So I understand Bruce Lee was obviously, you know, one of the penultimate badasses of that particular era, and he wanted Brad Pitt's character to get a one-upsmanship over him. But I also question, like, why Bruce Lee, and why, like, turn him into such a caricature when every other celebrity that is depicted on screen is given a little bit more of a reverent treatment. So this just kind of stood out to me. And like you said, if it wasn't for maybe some other moments throughout his oeuvre that this would have just been cringeworthy and not necessarily something that would have stuck out as a thorn in my particular side. But that's just where I stood on it, and it just, like I said, it just kind of made my skin crawl. But I want to, you know, do kind of a compliment sandwich and, you know, talk about one thing that I liked in that is that just there are a lot of fun cameos in this movie, and I want to try to enjoy this as best as I can because life is terrible. But, you know, there are so many like famous faces that pop up. You mentioned Bruce Dern. I mean, that whole Manson family compound scene is littered with cameos, that, and some of which I was looking at IMDb. I didn't even fucking realize Rumor Willis was in this movie. There are just so many people that pop up. Maya Hawke is in this. What's her name from Girls? Lena Dunham. Yes, thank you. Clifton Collins Jr. shows up in here. Luke Perry, God rest his soul, and, you know, shout out to his son, who is now in the dinosaur wrangling business, I guess I'll call it. You know, and there's just a lot. And Emil Hirsch, I don't understand why this guy is still acting after the crap he's pulled, but he shows up as Jay Sebring, the Sundance thing. Remember where he beat up an executive? Yeah. It was like, yeah, it was.
I forgive him. I like Emil Hirsch as an actor.
to each their own, I suppose. But, you know, it's just like, it's fun, and you really, Timothy Olyphant, one of my favorite actors from, and that this is solely based on his performance on, and he's a solid actor in general, but his work on FX's Justified is just absolute next level stuff for me, and it's just, and it's good to see him kind of back in that cowboy little, you know, rootin' tootin' role. But I can't, rootin' tootin', what the hell's wrong with me? It's just, you know, it's obviously there are people, and we didn't even mention Al Pacino. I mean, Al Pacino just is, he's just kind of there, and this is like a very broad caricature. There's really nothing too interesting about his character, so be it, whatever. But there's just that there's, you know, a lot of fun little winking at the camera stuff that I think Tarantino can pull off just right, and it's just enough, like, you know, he uses the tools of filmmaking to a degree that a lot of people just cannot even comprehend, and that's fine. I just think I guess I'll wrap it up by saying a lot of times he's his own worst enemy, and I think a lot of there's a lot of stuff in his head that comes out on screen that I think he should maybe work through.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. And like I said, you know, with you know, Tarantino's previous films, you know, I've been greatly entertained by a lot of them, but like we've alluded to, you know, the emotional connection isn't there. And like I said, in that sequence where Rick Dalton is on set with that girl, I felt like there was real meat there. And that's what I liked about it. I just wish there was more of that throughout, you know, the rest of the film, as it didn't feel like there was a lot of meat there, or I understood exactly what Tarantino's intentions were with telling this story, other than, you know, it being sort of a pseudo to Sharon Tate or something, as a lot of people have surmised, as it feels like, you know, with the ending and the way they leave it or whatever, it feels like sort of a tribute, I guess, on that, you know, level. But, you know, like I said, I think it's one of the more intriguing films of Tarantino's career, but also one of the more flawed films of his career. But like I've said a few times now, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to revisiting it eventually. I'm probably not going to go to the theater again. Obviously, it's a longer movie, to say the least. But when it comes back out, you know, I'll watch it at home and I'll see if anything has changed. I also feel like sometimes it's good to give it a bit of time, you know, after seeing a film to revisit it. And then maybe you'll look at it in a completely different way. And I hope I see it, you know, I hope I see some of these things in a different light. But like I said, I think it's one of Tarantino's more flawed films, you know, that he's made. At least, you know, it's not, you know, one of these classic Tarantino pieces of entertainment, I guess you could say, as, you know, a lot of his other films are just, you know, purely entertaining, violent, you know, and they work, you know, on that level. Here, like I said, there was elements that I feel like, oh God, he's getting at something different. This is a Tarantino I want to see. And then it just sort of, you know, goes away at a certain point. So, like I said, you know, I think I enjoyed the film, you know, overall. But like I said, when I see it again, I think I'll know for sure my feelings on the film. But with that in mind, I guess we can turn our attention to our next episode, where, like I said before, we're going to skip over Hobbs and Shaw, and we're going to focus on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, as well as The Farewell, which has gotten a big critical reception, starring Awkwafina, and I'm definitely looking forward to checking that out.
And honestly, I'm kind of looking forward to Academy Award nominee Awkwafina come January. But as always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.